I'm Michael Williams, and welcome to Blueprint for Living. This week, it's an exercise in finding beauty in the everyday. When did you last scrawl a map on the back of an envelope to tell a friend how to get to your house or a shop or buried treasure or some such? Because I reckon we can tell a lot about you by the topographical features you chose to include. It'll tell us everything about your personality. Were you more concerned with accuracy or character? Handmade maps with a collector and an artist coming up in the show today. Plus a wallow in nostalgia. Food and travel writer Jane Lawson is encouraging us to crack open the musk sticks and, frankly, attempt a diabetic coma with a lime spider. We're exploring a cookbook of recipes inspired by the classic Australian milk bar. All that and journalist, former foreign correspondent and storyteller Stan Grant. Stan's taking us to Pakistan, where we'll talk about place, about country and about restlessness in sense of place. Do stay with us. But before we get to Stan, let's come back to that idea of beauty in the everyday. Leaving aside the subjectivity of aesthetic judgment, what value is there in this seemingly endless quest for the beautiful, for some idea of perfection? There's a new book out by curator and architecture writer Karen McCartney that explores the Japanese Zen philosophy of wabi-sabi. That's the idea of finding perfection in the imperfect, celebrating aesthetic value in the weathered, the worn, and the generally beaten up. Her book is called Perfect Imperfect, The Beauty of Accident, Age, and Patina, and she joins us now. Hi, Karen. How did I go? Did I describe wabi-sabi adequately?
Oh, you were perfectly imperfect there.
That's what I go for. That's my speciality. talk us through it, because it's rooted in Zen Buddhism. Where does the tradition of wabi-sabi come from?
It's a very interesting kind of deeply held Japanese philosophy. And so when people ask me sort of for sound bites, like, is it a bit of a trend? I always feel deeply uncomfortable because it's a sort of this quintessential Japanese aesthetic. And it's the beauty of the imperfect, the impermanent and the incomplete and also things with a modesty and a humbleness. There's a wonderful book by Leonard Koren called Wabi Sabi for Artists, Designers, Poets and Philosophers. And that's the book I would recommend even over mine that people read on this subject, because it gives a really beautiful understanding of the nuances. We've taken some of those principles, but actually also dialed it up into a sort of modernity, in that we've looked at current designers and how they use process and how they embrace accident in their work, and then what those outcomes are.
You clearly don't understand the principles of promoting a book. Don't plug Leonard Curran's book above your own. But I do like, there's that quote from the Curran book that says, wabi-sabi is about beauty coaxed out of ugliness. So it doesn't deny the ugly state of the thing, but that beauty is somehow in there to be drawn up to the surface.
I absolutely love that. And I collaborated very closely on this book with the photographer Sharon Cairns and the stylist Glenn Probstall. And we worked together to kind of really tell this story in pictures and words. And because we were working all over the world, Glenn's in New York, Sharon is in Melbourne, I'm in Sydney, I sort of drew up a bit of a list of things that I felt we all needed to hold in our heads when we were looking for subjects and looking for content for this book. And that was one of the key things, because it's quite a tricky thing to get your head around. And there is something about beauty in the eye of the beholder. But how do you find that point? And actually, we find it in a chair that it was slightly contentious for us to begin with, because when you're collaborating with people, even if you have a very clear goal, we all come at it from slightly different perspectives.
Tell us about that chair. Bring the chair to life.
Well, the chair it's called the Well Proven Chair. It was designed by young designers, James Shaw and Marianne von Aboul, and they were looking at the properties of reusing materials. And so what they did, they discovered that if they combined a sort of bio-resin with wood shavings that were from the factory floor, and then they put them on the back of this chair, and it sort of did a sort of strange alchemy overnight, and it hardened into this sort of carapace on the back of the chair that looks almost volcanic. So it's definitely on the borderline of ugly and beautiful. But it was a chair that my husband put me onto for this project. And, you know, it was a bit of a challenge for Glenn and Sharon to photograph this chair. But they have made it look so wonderful because it's shot in a very old house in Shoreditch in London. So you've got that great sense of patina and age and history combined with this very contemporary chair, which is quite challenging to look at.
It is extraordinary. I mean, it's this lump in shape that looks like it's kind of black lava, and the chair's kind of emerged from it. But that's not accident. I mean, as you describe it, that comes from a very careful bit of craft. Modern design, how much is this just the aesthetic of the rough hewn rather than happenstance getting us to that ugliness?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the chairs come out within a sort of realm of, you know, one has a similar look to the other, but no two are the same. So there is this, the accident is in the process. And, you know, it was interesting, a lot of the people that we interviewed, we chose them because of their aesthetics. But when we began to talk to them, boy, did they over-deliver in terms of how this was so much at the heart of their practice. You know, talking to one ceramicist, she said, well, I asked about accident. She goes, well, hey, we commit our work to fire. You know, you don't get much more elemental and you know, so accident or some...
She was the Tasmanian one, wasn't she?
She's called Nicola Tassi, and she is in London. And she also, you know, a lot of it is about observation. At least two of the people in the book, the sculptor Alison Coates and Nicola Tassi, said a lot of it was about observing accident. So in the case of Nicola Tassi, she had put rejects up on a shelf and they'd sort of slightly slumped into one another like they were sort of a bit tipsy. And in observing this, she then took that idea and created a range where there's no utility in these objects, but they slump and she's glazed some in a beautiful celadon and called one of something, you know, with a Hogarth in it, referring to, you know, drunken sort of works. And so it's about observing accident and seeing the potential in accident and understanding how you can draw on that. Because, you know, we're all so busy, we just sort of work through things. Oh, those things have fallen. Have they fallen beautifully? Well, do we observe that or not? And I think that's the thing of these artists. They observe the happenstance.
Those ceramic examples are particularly acute. And as you say, part of it is the artistic practice relies on something like fire that's going to be unpredictable and kind of changeable every time. But how do you apply these design principles then across something like interior design? Because how do you get the mix of it? If it's serendipity and happenstance, it can't be reproduced again and again, can it?
That's the joy of it, you see. I mean, it was interesting, we don't have many architects in the book because architects tend to like precise lines. But the one architect we have featured is John Wardle, and it's his Bruny Island Shearer's Quarters, which is an award-winning project. But he is a collector, and so the place is filled with things that he has acquired. And he collects everything from Apple paraphernalia and mechanical things through to books and shells he's found on the beach. And then he finds ways to put those things together that are quite inspiring and beautiful. For example, his books, Behind the Fire, they start with the orange and red covers and segue as it becomes cooler to the green and blue covers. So these kind of thoughtful plays on things, you know, they're quite touching. His mother apparently was a librarian, so it's something of a family joke the way he approaches his books. But again, that sort of, there's a lightness and there's a play and an understanding of how things can come together that's both aesthetically pleasing and often functional as well.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living, and I'm talking with Karen McCartney about her new book that looks into the idea of wabi-sabi, beauty in the everyday and in the imperfect. The other thing about that kind of curated chaos that comes from selecting these things for interior spaces is the potential for it to much more readily reflect the individual values and personalities of the person in question, presumably.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, one of the places that we featured is by these kind of celebrity, which doesn't really go with Wabi Sabi at all, celebrity, but they're high-end American designers called Roman and Williams, and they started on film sets and working with Ben Stiller, and they have a country place in Montauk, where their personality is so completely and utterly expressed because it's collected and fined and characterful and beaten up and different textures and old sea prints that they have all together on a wall. And it's not about expense and spending a lot of money. It's about a kind of a sort of dedication to that expression of your personality. And they say that of all the projects they've done, it's still the most quoted back to them. It really resonates with people, and that is because it's utterly and truly them.
So then what if people want to embrace the spirit of this in their own kind of home, in their own kind of aesthetic? Where do you even begin?
Well, you know, there is a fine line between mess and creative clutter.
Yeah, not that fine, I wouldn't have thought.
No, exactly. And so I think it's about, honestly, conviction and caring about it. It doesn't just, like anything in life, it doesn't just happen. You need to make it happen, and you need to think about it, and you need to plan it. But once you decide, I'm going to collect seascapes from charity shops, and you do that with a degree of commitment, and you get 20 of them, and you put them up on a wall, you know, none of it is actually hard. It's just having the desire to do it and make it happen. But it doesn't happen by itself.
One of the things you point to in the book is that that Western practice of when something's broken, it's done and we throw it out. And the fact that part of the appeal of this is seeing the new beauty of the half-mended or the worn and torn thing. Can you talk a little bit about Angkor Wat and the copper ice cream scoops?
Well, it's so, this was one of the things that actually really, it was like a ka-ching moment for me. I talked to Guy Coulomans, who designed the ice cream scoops, and what was interesting was he wanted to recreate the famous 1930s aluminium ice cream scoop, and he thought, oh, well, copper is even more conductive, I'll do it in copper. But what he found, it was such a volatile material that the company that he got to try, they sent him back the unworkable version as a non-chargeable failure. And it was like something that had been dug up from an archaeological site. It was all eroded and corroded and matte. And he then did a perfect version where he infilled it with tin. And this is the perfect, shiny, complete, but all the eroded bits that are filled with tin are very evident. And so he then began to explore that idea of the fracture and looked at Japan and how the fracture, you know, something would be broken but then filled with gold and became more precious as a result. Whereas here, you know, I was thinking about, you know, that idea of, you know, if you've got a woolen or cashmere sweater and the moths get it, you know, we tend to think, oh, it's done, rather than getting a beautiful blue thread and you know, stitching it, because we're trained to believe that the mend is a failure or declares our poverty or an actual fact. This turning it on its head and giving it a new life is actually a very beautiful notion.
Karen McCartney, you've given a beautiful philosophy behind my general demeanour of shabbiness, and I'm grateful to you, no end. Karen McCartney, curator and author of many books on architecture. Her latest book is Perfect Imperfect, The Beauty of Accident, Age and Patina, and it's out now from Murdoch Books. And Canberra's Hotel, the Nishi Gallery there is going to have an exhibition of objects from the book, overseas and local, which runs until the 8th of May. We're coming back to the idea of finding beauty in the misshapen and handcrafted a bit later in the show this morning, when I talk with a couple of guests about handmade maps. Can we find beauty in that biro-scrawled set of directions to a wedding? Or if we can't find beauty, can we find the wedding at least? That's coming up a bit later this hour here on Blueprint for Living, so stay with us.
Coming up in the science show, Big Bang with the Bryans. Australia's Nobel laureate Brian Schmidt with America's superstar Brian Greene on superstrings, other universes, wormholes and colliding black holes. It's a cosmic romp.
Dark matter is, well, it's interesting because we don't know what it is, but it's pretty boring.
Have we ever seen a wormhole? No. If we did have a wormhole, could we actually travel through it? Probably not.
The Science Show today at midday here on RN. At the high tide line, driftwood and shells, that's where she said we could leave our clothes, where the moonlight dissolves in the wet sand.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living, and for Sense of Place today we go with a storyteller who's lived his life on the road. Stan Grant is one of Australia's finest storytellers and leading journalists. He's been a political correspondent for the ABC, a news and current affairs anchor for the Seven Network and SBS, and for more than a decade he was a foreign correspondent for CNN based in Asia and the Middle East. He reported from war zones, Myanmar, North Korea, Sri Lanka. He's really been everywhere, and now he's back home. He's the international editor for Sky News, managing editor of National Indigenous Television, and Indigenous Affairs editor at The Guardian. Quite a good man to talk to about his sense of place. Stan, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Look, before we get any further, you, as is traditional for this segment, chose that track that led us in. It's She's Been Talking to My Friends by the Mutton Birds. Tell us the significance of that piece of music to you.
Well, it really captures, like all great songs, a time and a place for me. You know, I spent a lot of time on the road reporting. I've reported from more than 70 countries. And that song really captures a period when I was spending a lot of time in Pakistan. It was the height of the Afghan war. We were on the Afghan-Pakistan border, traveling a lot around the remote areas of Pakistan up into the northwest frontier. And we used to listen to a lot of music. And I was introducing my crew, my cameraman, who is an Iranian-American, to music from my part of the world, from New Zealand and Australia. And I always loved the Mutton Birds, a beautifully evocative music, lovely sort of melodies. And he really took to that song, and he loved the album. It came off The Envy of Angels. And we played it incessantly. We were both guitarists as well, so we used to spend a lot of time, you know, trading songs, swapping songs around and listening to songs and learning how to play them. And that really evokes that period for me of being there covering a great story, an enormously important story, with people who are very, very close to me, and traveling this sort of remote, isolated, very distant country, and yet at the same time feeling close to my part of the world.
It is so important, that kind of music from home, when you're in a different space like that. So why is it that Pakistan stands out for you? Well, we often ask guests, just to show listeners behind the curtain, we ask guests for a place that has influenced them or really changed or shaped their lives. As I said in the intro, you've been a journalist all around the world. What was it about Pakistan in particular?
Well, Pakistan was, well, look, it was an adventure story. It's an extraordinary country with an incredible history, of course, carved out of partition with India, a country that has been in a fight for its own survival. There is a struggle for the soul of Pakistan, a country that is torn between radical Islamic extremism on the one hand and this sort of quest for democracy and civilian government on the other. And that struggle has really defined the country. I was always attracted to the turbulence of the country and that sort of story. Of covering the war zones of Iraq and Afghanistan as well would often be very confined experiences. There were limits on where you could go, and you had to get permission, and you had to go out with the American military, in our case, because I was working for CNN, American company. In Pakistan, it was a free-for-all. If you wanted to drive to the Afghan-Pakistan border, then you could. You may not make it back out alive, but you certainly could do it. It was a country that was tearing itself apart. There were more terrorist attacks in Pakistan than Afghanistan and Iraq combined since 9/11. It's a country that's always fascinated me. But apart from that, it reminded me of home. There was a physicality to it. You find gum trees in Pakistan. Islamabad, where our bureau was based, reminded me a lot of parts of Australia, particularly around Canberra. So it was evocative as well as a sense of place and a reminder of home, the smells and the sights and the sounds, but at the same time exotic and distant, remote and also turbulent. So as a reporter, it was an extraordinary mix.
That resonance you write about really beautifully in the book. It's, you know, you expect that thing about the foreignness, particularly, I imagine, in a war zone or a place where you're witnessing the kind of violence that you did. But you write in your book, as a reporter, I was drawn to those stories that mirrored my own. Always I sought to answer this question: how do people live meaningful and dignified lives when all certainty had been removed? And when I reported on these stories, I met myself. In the eyes of an Afghan refugee, I saw the eyes of people in my family. That seems like a particularly powerful kind of description of what you're saying.
And it was a powerful experience. I learned about myself by being away from my own country. It sharpens your perspective of home and your perspective of your own country. I'm drawn to writers who have had that expatriate experience. People like James Baldwin, the black American writer who wrote so powerfully about the United States while living effectively in exile in France, in Paris. I'm drawn to that expatriate experience and the quality of the perspective that it brings. I also found that in reporting the stories of countries that have been shaped by the big forces of history, China, North Korea, Afghanistan, Pakistan, right throughout the Middle East, I saw the forces that were shaping my own people, Indigenous people in Australia, because we shared those same experiences. That's why I say I really met myself out there.
What year was it that you first went to Pakistan?
Oh, I'd been reporting Pakistan on and off since the 9/11 bombings in 2001. Of course, the war in Afghanistan began very quickly after that, and I'd been for the pretty much 10 years covering Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, travelling out of there. I was based in Hong Kong, I was based in Beijing, then I was based in the Middle East itself for a while, working out of our bureau in Abu Dhabi with CNN. So I was there a lot. What would happen is that we would go into these countries and maybe spend 6 to 8 weeks, come back out, have a break for a while, transition with someone else, and then go back in again. It was this sort of rolling bureau arrangement that we had. And I always looked forward to it in a strange way, because obviously it was inherently risky and there was a lot of danger and there was a lot of tragedy that we reported on. But to see people living lives of meaning and dignity, to see people get up each day, to find the will to go on, to the love of their families, the love of their country and communities, what gave them that resilience really fascinated me.
How hard is it to feel like you get to know a place as a foreign correspondent? How hard is it to feel embedded in a culture, in a community, amongst a people, when you have the trappings of the media company and the journalism around you?
Yeah, and of course, that creates a lot of issues of guilt, to be honest with you, as well, because you do tend to go in and out and report on these stories and get very close to the stories and very close to the people, but ultimately we can leave and they can't, and they're trapped there in those circumstances, and it does create a lot of angst, a lot of guilt, sometimes a feeling of shame as well. I felt that I could get very close because I immersed myself in these countries, immersed myself in the histories of these countries. I would read a lot. I would get out and meet local people. I was fortunate as well in that I worked with an Iranian cameraman who's one of my best friends, Farhad Shadrovan, and he and I, of course, blended in. You know, dark skin, and he's dark skin, and he spoke, particularly up in Afghanistan, he spoke Farsi, which is very close to Dari, the language, one of the languages of Afghanistan. So we were able to move around a lot and dressed in local clothes. We could go and sit in a local restaurant. We could talk to local people without standing out. It didn't have blonde hair or red hair or pale coloured skin, so we could actually sit in there and blend in and get to know people. It gave me an extraordinary vantage point. We also worked very closely with local people. We had local people employed in our bureaus, and they were our eyes and our ears, they were our interpreters, but they were our friends as well, and I learned about the country through those really close bonds of friendship.
There's a lovely line in your book about your life being spent looking out a window. You use it to describe the comfort you have being in a car, watching the stars above you and kind of still moving. But there is that distance when you're looking out a window rather than being amongst it. Have you returned to Pakistan not for journalistic reasons? Is it a place that you would go back to as a visitor?
It is most definitely a place I would go back to as a visitor. I spent so much time there, of course, as a reporter, and was constantly going there as a reporter that I didn't have any need to go there and visit or be a tourist. But I certainly would. I would certainly live in a country like that. It holds great memories for me, but it also reminds me so much of home. And you know, that experience of looking out a window, I spent most of my early childhood, certainly up to my teens, travelling around the back blocks of New South Wales, moving from one town to the next with my parents, who were itinerant, transient people. We were, you know, living a life of poverty. It was a hand-to-mouth existence, but we had, again, the strength of family and culture, and that sort of allowed us to survive. And I got that observer's eye, that ability to sit in a car and look out and imagine, and look at other people's lives and imagine what happened in their lives. And I think that's really helped me as a journalist.
When you talk about that youth and the crisscrossing of those back roads, you talk about, in the context of your father in particular, the idea of restlessness. Is that something you feel you've inherited yourself?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Whether it was an inheritance or whether it was sort of more nurture rather than nature, it was certainly what I experienced a lot. And I do feel the need to keep moving. I like those new experiences. I like that sense of adventure. I like the idea of wondering what's just up around the corner, never saying no to another opportunity because you never know where that will lead. I like that. I like the precariousness of that existence. I don't feel comfortable, or I certainly don't trust stability so much. I wrestle against that. I really struggle with the idea of being trapped or caught in one place and having to have that stability in my life. The difficulty, of course, is in you're managing a family, as I have, and so on. It's hard to be able to have that consistency and be around, but also have that wanderlust. So, look, it is certainly something that I yearn for, but also have to struggle to curtail.
I'm so interested because your new book, Talking to My Country, is that notion of country and that notion of belonging and roots is so central to it. So that tension for you between the kind of restlessness and at the same time an acute understanding of where you've come from, what was the moment for you where you felt a shift? Because you yourself have said you previously made a conscious effort not to be an Indigenous reporter, not to be grounded, to be one that was kind of looking outwards. Do you remember the moment when you felt that it was time for that shift for you?
It wasn't a conscious thing as such, because I always carried that with me, because our country and our sense of country is so deeply embedded in our identities. We don't have to be on country to carry that with us. And I always felt that great sense of connection. It was what I connected with in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan or China or North Korea. I could look at people and see that they were people of the land too, that they connected to their country and I could connect to them through my connection to country, that I didn't have to be on it to carry it with me. So it wasn't a conscious decision. I certainly wanted to be free of the shackles of our history. I certainly didn't want to be defined and limited by the low expectations that can really choke off the ambitions and aspirations of so many Indigenous people. I wanted to be free to experience everything the world had to offer, and I really bristled against that idea that I would be put in a box. But ultimately, I think coming back to Australia 2.5 years ago now reawakened me to the story of my own and my own people, and physically reconnected me to that place. And as things have emerged, as events have taken shape, my life has sort of moulded to those events. And I've grown into a place now where I can speak about these issues with some authority, have a different perspective because of the experiences that I've had living away from Australia, and also bring a quality to my writing or speaking about this that is informed by 30 years of journalism. I've arrived at the right place to be able to tell the right story that matters to me now.
Stan Grant, thank you so much for joining us on Blueprint for Living today.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
Stan Grant is the international editor for Sky News, managing editor of National Indigenous Television, and Indigenous Affairs editor at The Guardian. And his new book is called Talking to My Country. It's out now from HarperCollins. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN and across the Asia Pacific on Radio Australia. When I was a kid, the milk bar around the corner was a decidedly mixed blessing. It was where we'd be sent to pick up milk or that inconveniently forgotten essential ingredient for dinner. But it absolutely reeked of cabbage cooking somewhere in a back room, and the guy who worked there was really very, very terrifying. But the upside was, if you had a fistful of coins, you could stand in front of the greasy glass cabinet and painstakingly pick on the lollies that you wanted for the walk back home. But the Great Australian Milk Bar has a longer, more varied tradition than old Mr. Cabbage's stale lolly bananas and Big Boss cigars. The platonic ideal of the milk bar is a chrome-plated wonderland of perfect musk sticks and neenish tarts, and it's a wonderland that's been captured in a new cookbook by food and travel writer Jane Lawson, packed with nostalgia and perfectly judged sugar rushes in equal measure. Jane Lawson, welcome to Blueprint for Living.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So why did you decide the milk bar was worthy of kind of this elevation? What nostalgia were you trying to capture?
Look, I actually wrote a book about 10 years ago called Grub Favourite Food Memories, which was more about the sort of home food you had back in the day when your mum or your grandmother was in charge of the stove. And I guess for about, you know, in the back of my mind since then has always been this sort of other side of that food from our childhood, which was, of course, the fun weekend stuff. And really, in those days, the only thing that was open was the milk bar on the weekend. And, you know, and there's so much attached to that, the memories of that time, that I felt that I just was a bit of an ode to my childhood, really. There wasn't particularly thinking about, you know, putting milk bars again on a, you know, pedestal, but it's just something that's really special to me and my family, and as it turns out, a whole bunch of other people.
Well, so you grew up on the northern beaches of Sydney in the 70s. What are some of those early milk bar memories that resonated with you as you started putting this together?
Well, it's funny, when you were talking about cabbage, I thought, I have no cabbage memories whatsoever, but I do remember a very strong, a kind of vanilla-y sweet cigar smell, because of course cigarettes and cigars were also sold in milk bars back in the day. So I think there was a mixture of sugar and all the sweets and that kind of fresh cigar tobacco or cigarette tobacco. So that was a strong memory. Obviously, as a child, running up the hill, walking in the heat of summer up to get an ice block or a bag of, you know, 20 cents worth of mixed lollies, and knowing that we're just going to indulge in that bag of treats when we get home and run under the sprinkler to get the sugar rush out of our systems. But also, as I was older, I guess, as a teenager, hanging out by the pinnies with the boys, watching all the cool boys, the surfers, and trying to be, you know, sort of semi cool ourselves and probably failing miserably, but they're the kind of strongest memories.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a moment of freedom. It's kind of, for a kid in Australia, it's potentially your first moment with a kind of commercial transaction, the handing over the coins and getting your mixed lollies or whatever it is.
Absolutely. Imagine, you know, you don't have, I guess, as a child, especially, you know, at a certain age, you really don't have very much opportunity to, you know, I guess, assert a certain freedom or sort of, I'm trying to think of the word, opportunity to, you know, kind of make a decision for yourself, as you say, and actually going up and choosing, not only spending the money, but choosing what you get to have and not having someone else dictate that to you, is a really special moment and important moment, I think, and actually being able to walk on your own. You know, these days kids don't have much opportunity to walk to the shops on their own, unaided by an adult or, you know, a gang of older children. It was such a freeing moment.
No, it's pretty magical. There is a figure that kind of appears in this book, though, which is your dad, who clearly played a big part, because part of the kind of food culture you're talking about is one that is equally found on road trips, looking for that perfect pie or looking for these pop-up shops that were about exactly that. Your dad was a big traveller for his job?
Well, he did. He was a salesman, so he was a sales rep, so he was on the road all the time. And he was just a massive foodie, I guess, before we coined the phrase foodie that we're not allowed to use anymore. And he really inspired. He was the one that got me into food, and I guess as a way of connecting to him, you know, both eating together and looking for food together and finding these exquisite treats, but also then that's what started me cooking and a whole career's worth of food. So he's really responsible for pretty much everything I've done the rest of my life. He's just a guts, really, and as am I. But he really was very much about finding the very best of everything he could, and that's what instilled that in me as well.
So you date the milk bar phenomenon back to the 1930s, and a man known as Mick Adams, but in that very Australian migrant way, that wasn't his actual name.
That's right. Exactly. Well, apparently he was looking for an alternative to the standard bars that were available, a sort of soft alternative, and really influenced by the American drugstore culture. It turns out that people did find ways of sneaking alcohol into the milk that was being served in shakes and making cocktails, which I find fabulous. It was such a popular thing that it really boomed and blossomed over the next 5 years or so. I think it went from sort of 1,000 to 4,000 milk bars, which sounds crazy, but it's understandable. If there's nothing else on offer, of course, they're just waiting to happen.
And one of the things that comes up in this book is a question of terminology, because we do use milk bar as a kind of catch-all for several different types of corner store shop, and it ranges from the corner store to the pie shop to the fish and chip shop. And so the book goes out of its way to break down those different manifestations of the milk bar. I just want to drill into a couple of specific recipe areas, though. Milkshakes, you have a whole section there. Yeah. How do you recreate that classic milk bar milkshake flavour?
Well, I think, unfortunately, what we sort of find today of the milkshake variety is pales in comparison to what we used to have. I think having a really good sort of homemade ice cream and good syrups and really good whole milk, and actually getting the quantities right, exactly how much flavour and how much ice cream do you put in that, in ratio to the milk. It seems like such a simple thing, but in actual fact, to get it absolutely right so you've got that real hit of that memory, well, what I remember, I'm sure that some people are going to have the book will not remember that at all, but it's just such an ultimate ice-cold, creamy hit of sweetness that you just need to get it right.
It is funny, though, you mentioned the dreaded foodie idea. Part of the flavours that would evoke nostalgia for this period aren't necessarily about the best artisanal ingredient. They're about a certain kind of simplicity of approach, the malt in a milkshake. Are there some kind of low-rent ingredients that you think are essential for creating that milk bar flavour?
Well, look, I'm all about using whole ingredients where we can, right? So, as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to make a chocolate syrup, actually, have good cocoa and some good, add a bit of good dark chocolate in there as well. And, of course, there's all the dreaded, no sugar sort of stuff that goes on at the moment. And, I'm certainly not saying throw sugar into your diet, everything you eat. But these are meant to be treat foods. And I think that's one of the things that people have to remember as well. But, I think I'm not going low rent on any of the ingredients in the book.
You have your own sherbet recipe. Like, you're not just slumming it and saying, go and buy sherbet. I am a little shocked by how easy sherbet seems to be to make.
I know. I actually had a message this morning from a friend who made it with her kids yesterday. And some friends of their kids, and now the kids have ordered this book for their 8th birthday. So, they loved it. Apparently, I'm sure they're still on a sugar home.
Not surprised. That is going to sugar people well and truly off the landscape. What about some of the slightly, because the section on pie shops is really interesting, the way in which the classic sausage roll and everything else. As we get more kind of conscious of ingredients and artisanal kind of approaches to these things, do we lose the nice kind of generic nature of the milk bar pie?
I guess it depends where you were buying your pies. Back in the day,
look, you never went generic. You had a better class of milk bar than I did, I think.
Obviously, on the northern beaches, we had. Look, I guess I took a little bit of artistic license on the pies. I just wanted to have a really really good pie recipes, the kind of pies that have chunks of meat or mince if you want them, there's options for all sorts. So depending on what your own memory is, you can kind of play around with that. And I even put Vegemite in the meat pie as well to give it a bit of Aussie kick.
Oh, excellent. Patriotic. Can I just ask to finish up, are milk bars dying? Are they being killed by the ubiquitous 7-Eleven?
Look, sadly, that's been happening for a long time. And when I was researching the book, I really was very sad to sort of find that there really wasn't that much left. But what I am heartened by is the fact that there's a whole bunch of young, clever things going, there's something to this milk bar thing, and starting to open up a few really cool little new places around town. So I'm kind of excited about seeing a resurgence of the milk bar. And in the realest sort of sense of the words, like really good, simple, yummy stuff that we don't have to, you know, be worrying ourselves about. Just a simple time.
I like an optimistic note there. And if you can't find a milk bar or a corner shop that brings you that same shot of nostalgia, you can recreate your own with Jane's help. Jane Lawson is the author of Milk Bar Memories. It's published by Murdoch Books. And Jane's recipe for musk sticks is on our website. Also, while you're there, make sure you share with us your milk bar memories as well. Thanks so much, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll tell you where to go. Hand-drawn maps.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN. Keep up with the latest in design, food, travel and gardens. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or the ABC Radio app.
I have a six-year-old at home, and amongst his many, I'm going to say enthusiasms, but I could just as easily say obsessions, none of them come close to his desire to draw a map. Wherever he goes, a map from the house to the school, a map through the house, a map of what the school looks like, the beach, everything, all with big kind of barely legible messages about what's around what corner and big crosses where the treasure hides. There's a kind of obsession that we all have with maps and ways to see the world that we live in. And my next guest, a visual artist, is a collector of hand-drawn maps. His name is Chris Harzinski, and he joins us via Skype from Pennsylvania. Chris, when did you start collecting maps?
I first started collecting maps when I realized I had kind of accidentally collected a few of them, and I was going through some old papers and was setting things aside, throwing most of that away, but then I found like three of these maps that my friends had drawn for me over the years, and I really enjoyed them and wanted to share them, and also kind of thought that with Google Maps and things, maybe they were something that people weren't doing quite as much of anymore. So I set up a website and, you know, found out that actually there's a lot of people who still have these things and draw them for each other. And so I just started, you know, a way to sort of collect them together.
That hand-drawn quality is the thing that drew you to it, and the thing that I'm really interested in, because it goes beyond kind of great cartography, beautiful kind of precise measurements of distance. It becomes kind of resolutely personal. Those first ones you pulled out from friends, what were their directions to?
One, for example, was how to get to their wedding. So it was a map to my friend's, you know, wedding site, and then where the event was going to be afterwards, you know, how to get from one place to the other, you know, things to see in the town while I was there, right? So like that has this real sort of story that starts to reveal itself, certainly in a personal way.
So what can you tell about a person from the way they draw a map?
To me, the most interesting thing is what they choose to share in the map, right? The sites. I think it can be interesting to see different ways that people choose to represent things. Like, how do you represent a stoplight, right? Or an intersection? I mean, there's so many different ways of doing that. And I think that those symbols can be really quite fascinating as well.
So why do you think they're enjoying a bit of a resurgence right now? Because this is, you know, as you say, the rise of Google Maps and things means that there's less reason to hand-draw directions to your wedding, but they seem to be everywhere. Why is that?
A part of me thinks that it might have to do with the fact that, you know, the map that I use every day, for example, is Google Maps, and it looks the same no matter where I go, right? If I'm in Philadelphia where I live, or I go traveling, you know, the street names change, but the aesthetics of that map still look exactly the same. So, you know, maybe it's just a desire to see the world through different eyes, right? Or through more sort of idiosyncratic interpretations.
So as a collector, tell me about some of the favorites that you've got in your collection.
Well, I personally really like the first few maps that I had. One of them was one that has a very specific memory to me that I collected on a trip with my father in Scotland. I took it out of the garbage and, you know, just sort of recognized it. It was a map of the United States, and someone was trying to draw all of the different states from memory, and they got them fairly close, but there's quite a few mistakes, and I think that those mistakes are kind of interesting.
So it's not about precision at all?
No, it's not about precision, right? It's about, I think, with that kind of map, for example, it's about, you know, getting the kind of overall idea and still communicating some sort of location or story or something.
Some people have absolutely no kind of visual aptitude, though, you know, no skill with graphics. Does that matter, or do some of the maps you collect have qualities that transcend whether the illustrations and graphics are any good at all.
Oh, I do not think that it needs to be about necessarily one's illustrative talent. A lot of the maps in my collection are things that I think people probably would have thrown away. You know, quick direction maps from one place to another, but they kept them for some reason, right? The same way reason that I kept the ones that I had. And so, no, I don't really think that the aesthetic matters that much. I think it's just what comes across it through the imagery.
Thank you so much for that, Chris. I've been speaking with hand-drawn map collector Chris Harzinski. We'll have a link to Chris's website, the Hand-Drawn Map Association, up on the Blueprint for Living program page, along with some great examples. But now to someone making a living out of drawing maps. Jenny Sparks is a UK-based graphic designer, and she sells her incredibly detailed maps of some of the world's major cities online. She was included in a Guardian list of the top 10 hand-drawn maps, and Jenny joins us now via Skype. Hi, Jenny. Thanks for joining us. How did you get into the hand-drawn map lark?
I started making hand-drawn maps in, like, 2012. I'd sort of just moved to London, and I just graduated from uni studying illustration. And it was actually kind of a weird sort of coincidence that it happened, because I'd never really drawn a map before, but I was commissioned by a company called Evermade.com. Because it was 2012, there was sort of the London Olympics coming up, and there was also like the Queen's Jubilee. Basically, they asked me to make a kind of a more cultural map of London than a geographical one.
So, is more cultural than geographical code for it doesn't have to be accurate?
Yes, yeah, totally. I mean, even though I do try to make things as accurate as possible geographically, obviously you can't really pick up one of my maps and use it to really navigate around. It's more of an art piece than a Google Maps style thing.
The charm of it. Are there elements, though, that you feel that you have to get vaguely right? I mean, what about something like scale? Does that contort what you're able to do? Or do you throw that out the window once you get going?
It's more like, so I pick out the main landmarks of a city first. So, you know, like in London, we've got like Big Ben, got Houses of Parliament, the Shard. When you're walking around London, you can kind of look up and see those things, and that gives you a way to navigate. So I usually pick out the landmarks first, and they are usually like larger on my maps than say like a bar or a restaurant or something. So yeah, I mean, I give them more prominence, but only because of the fact that they are sort of more well-known and important for local people.
For those who haven't seen your maps, they're incredibly kind of intricate and dense in terms of detail. So kind of a...
Thank you.
This is going to be... Well, you've just thanked me, and now you're going to be less grateful at the comparison. Kind of Where's Wally-esque? Is that a reasonable...
No. Yeah, no. I mean, people have compared it to sort of Where's Wally style things before, but I think people like them because you buy the map and then you have it on your wall, and it's a piece of art that you kind of don't really stop discovering things with, because it's so detailed that you can have it for a few months and then you'll see something that you never saw before.
I was interested to read on your website, you mentioned that when you're asked to do the one of London, you were explicitly asked to subvert the idea of a traditional tourist map. But what do you think they meant by that? What did you take that to mean?
That's actually why I got so excited about the project, because London's a massive, you know, it's a well-known tourist city, and I get so many tourists every year. And, you know, obviously you've got like the main landmarks that people go to, like, you know, Big Ben and like Buckingham Palace and stuff like that. But for me, like, my favorite part about traveling anywhere, to be honest, is finding out those bits and bobs that are kind of more local, and then you really kind of understand what the city or the place is about. And I think that's why I really enjoyed making the London map, because it was not just sort of North London, which is actually where most of the landmarks are and the tourist spots are, but it was sort of South London as well, which is, it was kind of more aimed towards locals as well as anybody that likes London. But I think I wanted to make it kind of a celebration of London as like a thriving city that people genuinely live their lives in. So I think that's what attracted me to it.
How long does it take you to do a map of a city? I mean, let's use the London one as an example still. How long did that take?
That one took me, so initially it's like usually about a 1 to 2 month period of just research. And I really like researching things. So, I mean, I literally just go through books and watch documentaries, go on the internet.
Do you need to go to the city?
Well, it's much better if I do, because there's like certain things that you can't really pick up on just online or just in a book. You know, especially when I did like a map of Paris, where obviously it's like in another language. So I'll just make up like spellings that are wrong that need to be checked by locals. And also, you know, there's certain things that, you know, you never, even like living in London for like 4 years, there's certain things that I'm still discovering. So you kind of need to have that local knowledge. So I usually go to visit the city after I've kind of done my research process. And then I come back to London and kind of collate the information. And overall, it takes about 3 to 4 months in total for me to go from like research to fully finished and edited and all drawn and everything and laid out. So yeah, it's quite lengthy. And they're quite long days as well.
So even if you abandon geographical accuracy, this is not something for the amateur kind of cartographer to pick up, is it? There's a little more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to toot my own horn too much.
No, toot away.
I mean, I think I'm quite a thorough person in general, and maybe I'm a little bit on the obsessive side. So, but I was never initially trained as a cartographer, and I've had cartographers sort of ask me how I do things or whatever. But I think part of the reason why they've kind of been, my maps have been quite successful is because of the fact that I am from an illustrator background. So I kind of have a bit more like, I don't know, a bit more fun with it. And I guess maybe because I don't have the constraints of like make it completely geographically accurate, it means that I can kind of inject a bit more personality into it.
I like that you're trying to combine fun and obsessiveness in just the right way. Does it mean that if someone asks you directions for something, you no longer scroll out a little hand-drawn map? You're too meticulous to take it frivolously?
Well, it's actually really bad. Like, I mean, I think, you know, everybody asks me, says like, you know, like now you've drawn the maps, you must know everything about London, you know, you must know where everything is. And actually, like, it's kind of like, you know, when you revise for exam and you pack all the information in and you do the exam, and then like afterwards you kind of like lose a lot of that. I don't think a brain can really store that much information, so I'm actually really bad with directions, which is quite funny.
Perfect. put it all into the work. It's the only way to go.
yeah, totally.
It's been absolutely great to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Graphic
designer, great to talk to you too.
Graphic designer Jenny Sparks. Links to her hand-drawn maps are up on the Blueprint for Living program page, and we would love photos of your hand-drawn maps to go on our Facebook page. You're going to be up against our kids. Obviously, we're pretty biased, so you're not going to win, but feel free to kind of throw in your best shot. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the story we did last week on hitchhiking produced a cavalcade of responses from you, our listeners, and we love them. Really amazing stories. The thing that really struck me about it, and I was talking to someone else about this during the week, was the overwhelming note of optimism in the stories that came back. People talking about not just grand adventures, but moments of real trust and connection with strangers, and we loved getting those stories. They're up on the website. I just wanted to mention a couple of them that I thought were particularly lovely. Ruth wrote about hitchhiking through Italy, going through the Dolomites and into Tuscany in a Porsche with a driver who quoted Dante to them all the way, quoting, "The hills of Tuscany give off the scent of 1,000 flowers. As Ruth said, imagine an Aussie bloke quoting poetry to us. Andrew talked about having to lie on the road to avoid swarming bees while hitchhiking. Veronica talked about the fact that she and her best friend used to hitchhike from the northern beaches of Sydney just to get to work, which seems like a good way to manage to drive through the transit lane. Not a terrible idea. And talks about the time that they were picked up by a chauffeur-driven black limousine that was on its way to pick up Sir Robert Helpman to take him to the Opera House. Sounds like the perfect way to hitch. The stories weren't all sweetness and light, though. Several stories of really terrifying experiences. Karen made the point that she definitely wouldn't recommend it, especially if you're female. 35 years ago, with a friend travelling by bus from Tel Aviv to southern Israel, she found herself on a sudden detour down a dirt track to the Red Sea, where the driver demanded that she strip off and go swimming with him. She refused, and he became very angry, fidgety, and kicked the side of the truck, pretty scary experience, and Karen said she wouldn't risk it at any cost. And a special mention has to go to Bill, who I think has a novel in him, with throwaway lines like, I could have been a pedophile or axe murderer for all they knew. Bill clearly had a ball doing it across pretty much every continent, as far as I can see. It is worth noting, though, his coda said, I really wouldn't want my own grandkids to hitch. So good enough for Bill, not good enough for Bill's grandkids. Those stories are all up on our program page this week, and I encourage you to get amongst it and add your own stories. Still to come, how do you feel about artistically inclined baristas crafting art projects on top of your coffee? Does it get up your nose, or do you want to learn more? That's coming up in just a tip.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN.
Coming up in the next half hour, does it bother you or delight you when the barista puts a special message for you on top of your cafe latte? I try to delve into the world of latte art. There are international competitions, and I'm going to get taught by a master on how to do it. Plus, we have Colin Bissett introducing us to another change maker of architecture. How did Peter Behrens make such an impact, and yet at the end of his career, be a pawn for Hitler? We find out more coming up in this half hour. This week, World Animal Protection called on online travel behemoth TripAdvisor to stop promoting the cruel wildlife tourist attractions that feature in various parts on their website. We also got a letter from a listener, Christina Paris, who had just returned from Thailand, and she wanted to let us know how horrified she was by the way the elephants were being treated for the sake of tourists. Then, compounding both those bits of news, the sad news that an elephant died in Cambodia this week after ferrying tourists in 40-degree heat. So it seemed like just the right time for us to delve into the ethics of elephant trekking. It may be on many tourist bucket lists, but there are calls to ban elephant trekking from within the industry, and some travel companies are refusing to include them in their tours. Jeff Manchester is a co-founder of Intrepid Travel, and Nicola Bynan is head of campaigns for Australia for World Animal Protection. Good morning to you both. Nicola, tell me a bit about the elephants used in trekking and the ways in which they're broken in, because that seems like a particularly grotesque part of this.
Yeah, that's right, Michael. Elephants in the tourism industry, they endure terrible cruelty throughout their lives, but it starts from the very beginning with that brutal process you referred to. It's known in the industry as the crush, and it's where a young elephant will be taken from its mother prematurely before it would be taken from its mother naturally in the wild, and it gets chained up in isolation and beaten for, it could be a number of days, up to a week, could be deprived of food. And the purpose of the process is to break the elephant's spirit, because elephants are naturally very dangerous animals. And so this process, they're put through it so that they learn to submit to human will, to human punishment, so that they will allow tourists to ride on their back or be trained to perform tricks for tourists in shows. So that's the start of this awful life that the elephants end up having in captivity for the sake of our entertainment.
What a distressing and brutal practice. I mean, it's so ubiquitous in cultural kind of things that we see, that idea of the ride on the elephant, and it's always this kind of romanticized sweet thing. But elephants, I guess what you're saying is they're just not built to carry people. That's not part of what they're capable of doing naturally.
That's right. It's not natural for them. It's not part of their natural wild instincts. And of course, in captivity, that's one of the problems. They can't fulfil their natural instincts to roam, to socialise in a herd with other elephants. And they're usually chained up. And the only walking they get to do is the endless rides with the tourists on their backs. But of course, we know that tourists do this because they love wildlife. They love elephants. They want to experience them. And we don't want people to feel guilty because the cruelty is hidden from the tourist. I mean, that's our role at World Animal Protection, is to bring the cruelty to light so that if you are someone who loves wildlife, you can cross this one off your bucket list and instead try and see wildlife in the wild where they belong.
Jeff, your company was one of the first travel companies to stop including elephant treks. In fact, from what I understand, you funded research into the treatment of elephants in Thailand. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, we worked with World Animal Protection to fund their research, and basically they went out and researched every establishment in Thailand that used elephants, tigers and primates within tourism, and most of those were elephants, and they found that nearly all of those establishments treated those animals inhumanely, and there was only a very, very small minority who did it in a good way. And so we decided that we would phase out elephant riding from what we were doing. And over a period of a couple of years, we did that. And, of course, we had concern that maybe no one would want to go to Thailand and travel with us anymore because people love elephants. But while people really enjoy elephant riding, it's not their one of their two or three main reasons for selecting the trip they did.
Why do you think elephant treks are so popular?
Because I think people like to have that romantic idea of having close-up contact with wild animals, and that's just seen as a very great way of doing it with elephants, whereas, in fact, walking along next to an elephant is far more pleasurable and far safer because it's a very long way up the top of an elephant, and the seats are very uncomfortable, and you've got to hold on for dear life.
So how much of this is an education thing? I mean, as soon as people have a better understanding of the kind of thing that Nicola outlined, are you finding that customers are no longer interested in it, that it's a problem of ignorance rather than indifference?
It's very much that way. We find any issue, if you educate people, they're willing to take it on. And we talk to people when they're on the trip about why we don't take them elephant riding and all about the things that Nicola's been talking about. And at that point, 99% of people just think, wow, that's terrible. I don't want to ride elephants. It's really bad that elephant people want to ride elephants, and they almost become crusaders against it.
Nicola, World Animal Protection is trying to pressure TripAdvisor to stop selling tours that are cruel to wildlife, not just elephants, but all wildlife. Why now in particular?
Well, TripAdvisor is the world's largest online travel platform. So they receive approximately 300 million hits a month to their websites, which means they've got tremendous potential to help steer the travelling public away from animal cruelty and instead towards wildlife-friendly attractions. So we really would like to have TripAdvisor's cooperation with this campaign. We did some research with Oxford University last year where we looked at wildlife tourism, and we estimated that over 500,000 animals are suffering in the tourism and entertainment industry. And TripAdvisor are selling or promoting a great number of those wildlife attractions that are cruel. So we're calling on them to stop selling tickets to those attractions themselves through their subsidiary Viator, and to stop promoting them with certificates of excellence and their popularity index, which ranks venues according to how popular they are, and instead to work with us on education and to perhaps put in place a wildlife friendly program where they would reward venues that are wildlife friendly in a similar way to what they do for venues that are environmentally friendly.
And how's that gone? What's their response been so far?
Well, we've been talking to them for a number of months behind the scenes, and we haven't had any real practical response from them. They haven't told us how they're going to help with this campaign and stop promoting and profiting from wildlife cruelty. So now we've gone public, and we're calling on supporters all around the world to help us persuade TripAdvisor to get on board with the campaign.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN. We're talking elephant trekking with Nicola Bunyan from the World Animal Protection, the Australian branch, and Jeff Manchester, who's a co-founder of Intrepid Travel. Jeff, last week we talked a bit about the conversation that's going on around the climbing of Uluru. And one of the arguments that comes up there is this idea of the economic necessities of it, that tourism props up communities and it's essential, and so we shouldn't impose other values on the top of that. Does that come up a bit when you try and campaign on things like this?
That does come up. But ultimately, the local community has to have a fair say on what happens in their area. And again, I'd go back to the fact that when most people understand, they're willing to forego an activity. The Uluru one is quite interesting because it's not so much foreigners coming to Australia who are the issue. It's more Australians who have this feeling that it belongs to them and they have a right to climb it. But I'm sure if they met the local people and learnt about how important Uluru is to those people and why they don't want people to be declining, well, then nearly everyone would be much more accepting of it. And as an alternative, the walk around Uluru itself is just fascinating.
But, you know, these are slightly different cases. We're talking about developing countries for things like these elephant trekking tours. What's the survival of those people who are dependent on this? Nicola, what's happening in Thailand? I hear the Thai government is taking steps to intervene.
We're working with the Thai government to try and persuade them to improve the rules and regulations around the tourism industry, which is so prevalent in that country. And we're also working with venues. It is our preference to always find a solution that helps people with their livelihoods as well as helping the animals that are suffering. So we're talking to venues to try and persuade them to, if they have elephants in captivity, to persuade them to look after those elephants with more care, to stop the rides, to stop those close encounters with the tourists, which require the cruel, brutal training that we talked about. So we hope to have success there, and it's great to be working with companies like Intrepid, who will then help steer tourists towards the venues that are progressive and elephant-friendly instead of dealing in elephant cruelty.
And are you seeing a kind of correlation between intervening to stop the tourism to these things and the actual programs being discontinued altogether?
It's going to be a slow process. The campaign's been very successful in terms of signing up tourists to be elephant friendly. We've had tens of thousands of Australians sign up with us to be animal friendly tourists. And we've had over 100 companies now worldwide sign up and pledge to say that they will no longer sell elephant rides or shows. And Intrepid was one of the first companies that did that. So the campaign is going well, but there's a long way to go. And we know that the industry is not going to be shut down overnight, but it's so important to reduce the demand and so that there's not that incentive for the industry to keep breeding elephants into these miserable lives of captivity and taking them from the wild for it as well.
Just briefly, the elephant trekking is only one such area of concern, I know, for World Animal Protection. What are the other kind of key areas where animal safety in the tourism trade is a concern?
We identified 10 attractions that have the most serious cruelty, and they include things like performing monkeys, where monkeys are forced to ride bicycles and shows for tourists, and the venues where you can go and have that selfie with a tiger, where the poor tiger is chained up all day in a barren concrete enclosure, and the places where you can go and pat a lion cub, and there's awful cruelty there where the cubs get taken from their mothers prematurely, and also where the cubs can go on and be sold into the hunting industry. Dolphinariums, there's quite notorious animal welfare issues with dolphinariums. So there's a range of tourist attractions, but to help tourists avoid the cruelty, we give them a basic rule of thumb, and it's if you can hug it, if you can ride it, or if you can have a selfie with it, then there's a good chance that that animal has suffered from cruelty, so best to avoid it.
Nicola Bynan is Head of Campaigns for Australia for World Animal Protection, and Jeff Manchester is co-founder of Intrepid Travel. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Pleasure.
Thanks ever so much.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN and the ABC Radio app. Have your say on this and other stories at the Blueprint for Living page on the RN website.
Milk and coffee have been consumed together for centuries. One of those perfect combinations, peaches and cream, milk and coffee. Legend has it, David Schomer started the US latte art craze in the mid-1980s. At the same time, a guy in Italy called Luigi Lupi was experimenting with decorating the lattes of discerning Italians. It's clearly a craze, how to make art out of the top of our coffees. And since then, it's developed into an actual honest-to-goodness art form with global competitions and artists racking up Instagram likes and followers by the thousands. But, you know, what's involved? How the hell do you make perfection out of a milky design? Ben Morrow is Australia's Pura Latte art champion, and he showed me how it's done and then gave me a chance to give it a try myself. Talk us through it. Because we're in St. Ali, it's a place, we're in Melbourne, so it's Coffee Snob Central. And this is a place that takes its coffee very seriously. So we're in front of a very nice Italian machine.
That's right. Ready
to go. You've got your milk jug and you're poised. Talk us through what you're doing.
Okay, so I've started with the milk jug just under halfway full. And from here, what we're going to do is imagine the volume on the side of the jug, cut that into four, and then add one more portion. So we're going to increase the volume by 20%. Okay, and we're going to increase it with air using the steam wand.
And why?
Because that's the amount of texture that makes a latte.
Okay, so you say texture. I'm going to move to a bit of terminology that I know is important to you latte artists. Microfoam. What the hell is microfoam?
So microfoam is just regular foam, but at a microscopic level. So if we looked at the surface of the milk after steaming it and took a magnifying glass to it, it would still look like bubble bath.
All right, do your stuff.
Okay. So from here, we're going to make sure that there's no liquid in the steam wand there. We start with the steam tip in the center, on the surface, just submerged, and then slightly move it to the left. So it's just on a tilt now. And by putting it on a tilt, it's going to create a vortex motion, right? So it's going to be spinning like a whirlpool. And that's really important when we bring air in, because we can gradually bring air in. We don't want to put too much in at once, because remember how we were saying it was made of bubbles? Those bubbles will be too great, and we won't be able to bring them to a smaller size using the vortex.
All right, delicate operation.
Yeah, so let's try and put all the air in we need in the first half of the time that it takes to make it as hot as we want it, which is about 55, 60 degrees. Whatever you feel like, you know, if you like hot coffee, that's cool. We can go up from there. And then what we end up with is shiny, glossy milk.
And silky.
Yeah, silky, smooth, creamy. Have a feel of that, have a play with it. It's not too hot.
No, warm to the touch. All right, keep us moving.
Okay, so from here, we'll need some espresso. And then we can move into doing a latte art.
So while you're hard at work making the espresso, what was your award-winning effort?
For the Australian title, I won with a fox pattern. The tail wrapped around the bottom, and then the fox sort of sat on top, or the body and the paws and stuff. So that was cute. I did that, and that was my designer paw. Then there was a free paw, which is just without any tools or anything. And then the last one is a macchiato pour. So if you've ever seen like a little espresso cup, you have to do something into that.
You said your tools. What are the tools?
The tools can be whatever you want. Generally, it'll be a thermometer or a skewer. Some people use chopsticks.
Nifty. And the milk you choose. For latte art, the quality of milk does affect how delicately you can make your art.
Yeah. Yeah. You can work with most milks to find a way to texture it well. Yeah, you probably want to be using like high quality fresh milk, because it'll be one, tastier, and two, it'll be easier to steam and texture with. And from here, it's just a matter of using a couple of sneaky techniques. So we just start off pouring high, and that brings a little bit of texture into the cup, and then low.
So it's all about the tilting, and there you have produced latte out in a single move. With your demonstration there, you produced a kind of classic tulip, or is that a love heart
the
on
tulip,
top of a
when the
of
first person who did that technique did it, it only had sort of two layers, and it really did look like a tulip head. And now when we say a tulip, we really just describe the motion. It's when we do a forward pouring motion in a stop start style.
You say we, like there's a kind of brotherhood of latte artists. Do you compare notes? Is there, I mean, do people say, okay, I've mastered, I've done a small Scotty dog, and this is how you do it, two to the left, one to the right?
It's an interesting thing. I think the biggest medium for that kind of community is on Instagram. And there's hundreds of Instagram latte artists that are really, really crazy good. I think a lot of people strive to do something new, something that they call a signature or that defines them. For me, flexibility is like the key component of making a latte art. Right on.
Oh, right on. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Beautiful. And then a little bit up. And then just down so we get in there and then off.
Too many bubbles in there?
I think we're actually okay. Don't hesitate. Try and pour the whole thing in 10 seconds.
Yep. Oh, my God. That is up. Oh, look at that. That's beautiful. That is a bird of prey.
Well done.
Obviously, you know, to the trained eye, that's a bird of prey. That is a thing of beauty. RN audiences are discerning types. I think they know true art when they see it. But that looks like a good
coffee. That's
coffee.
A winner.
Yeah. We're there.
That's pretty good.
It is genuinely hurtful to me that they don't call competitive foam crafters lartists. I mean, what a missed opportunity. What are these people even doing? There's a video on our Facebook page of my truly appalling effort at latte art alongside Ben Swan, which is quite nice and looks, in fact, like a swan. If you try your hand at it at home, do your best in microfoam and post the photos of your efforts up on our Facebook page. We'd love to see them, as long as they're worse than mine.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
Ah, Frank Sinatra. There's no one quite like him, is there? One of the ways that an architect or designer can make a lasting impact on the world is through the other practitioners they teach and mentor. And this week, Colin Bissett looks at the mixed but incontrovertible legacy of Peter Behrens.
Peter Behrens is an architect many people have never heard of. And yet, between 1907 and 1911, he had three men working in his Berlin office who would become the most acclaimed and influential architects of the 20th century: Walter Gropius, Mies van der Rohe, and Le Corbusier. That fact alone makes Behrens a remarkable figure, and it begs the question, what did Behrens do to attract men of this calibre? His beginnings were quiet, starting out as a painter in the 1880s and finding an affinity with graphic design, notably the woodcut, which displayed his interest in the flowing lines of Art Nouveau. He was curious about industrial design, though, and by 1907 he had helped set up the Deutsche Werkbund, a design group which aimed to ennoble German work. They took the English arts and crafts notion of handicraft and gave it an industrial twist, proving that machine-made objects could be both functional and beautiful. Importantly, they demonstrated that no object was beyond the reach of fine design, a key principle of the emerging modern movement. At the same time, Behrens had joined an artist's colony in Darmstadt, where he designed his own house and everything within it, and all with such accomplishment that his fame quickly spread. He was summoned to Berlin and hired as the artistic consultant to the huge electrical firm, AEG. His masterstroke was to create a unified visual character for everything to do with the company, from stationery and advertising to the company's products and its buildings. This makes him the world's very first industrial designer, introducing the idea of brand identity, which we're so familiar with today. The Turbine Hall of 1909 was hugely influential, a masterpiece of form and function, with a steel structure and huge glass windows that give the industrial building almost a classical monumentality. It's a space that functions beautifully today. His work for AEG made him one of the most sought-after designers in Europe, but as commissions flooded in, he was unable to cope. The young Le Corbusier complained that Behrens had fallen victim to his success and lost all control over what anyone did, becoming intractable, unapproachable, immersed in his rebarbative ill humour. Behrens's star fizzled, although he continued to work, building the first truly modern house in Britain in 1926 and heading the Prussian Academy of Arts in Berlin. But nothing came close to his work for AEG. He died in 1940 with the promise of work on Hitler's reimagined Berlin. A controversial end, perhaps, for a major talent.
That was Colin Bissett there with his latest change maker. Today's stories, last week's stories, everything we've ever done lives on in internet form via the Blueprint for Living part of the RN homepage. Go and have a dig around. It's a treasure trove. So many stories to listen to and even read, because really, we're never done with work. We're out of here for another week. If you're listening to this via the podcast, hooray! Also, recommend it to your friends. Get them a subscription for their birthday. It's a nice, cheap gift. And if you're listening via the wireless, why not subscribe as well? That way you can catch us any time and place at all. Coming up next week, we start a new series looking into the world's greatest. From train journeys to gardens to food markets, we're going to spend some time with those places staking a claim for doing it better than anyone else. And we're kicking it off with the world's greatest wildlife destinations. Anne Jones is up next with Off Track, looking into the fish off the coast of Sydney's South Head who make their home in an artificial steel reef. Until next week, bye from us. Bye.
So you'll add to the local colour, serving coffee with a cruller. Dunking doesn't take a lot of skill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. Man, they got a gang of coffee in Brazil. Hey, Pedro, get the flashlight, I cannot find the sugar.